If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of Beyond Borders on the True Crime Never Sleeps show. As always, I'm your host, Larry Lease. And today, we're going back to Italy and diving into the murder of Meredith Kircher. Let me know your thoughts on this case, because it is definitely one of the most infamous international murders, probably almost of all time, I would say. And without further ado, let's dive in. Meredith Kircher was a 21-year-old British exchange student who, on a crisp autumn night in November 2007, was brutally murdered in Perugia, Italy. Her death not only shattered her family and circle of friends, but also ignited a media firestorm that drew the world's attention to a small university town. Over the course of the next 8 years, a convoluted legal saga would unfold, one that involved multiple trials, conflicting forensic evidence, contradictory witness statements, international outrage, and a spotlit interrogation of Amanda Knox and Rafael Solicito. In the process, the Kircher murder case raised profound questions about forensic science, media sensationalism, and how two young people became the faces of a tragic and still enigmatic crime. Tonight, we dive deep into Meredith's background, the night of her murder, the investigative twists and turns, the trials and appeals, and the lingering controversies that ensure her story remains both haunting and essential to understanding how justice can sometimes stray far from clarity. Meredith Kircher was born on December 28, 1985, in Southwark, London, to John Kircher, a window dresser turned art curator, and Arlene Kircher, a former nurse turned teacher. Meredith grew up alongside her older sister Laura and younger sisters Stephanie and Nicola in Coldstone, a suburb south of London. From an early age, Meredith exhibited a keen intellectual curiosity, combined with a natural warmth and enthusiasm for life. She was academically driven, earning high marks in her A-levels, and she was well-liked by her peers for her humor, compassion, and quiet confidence. When Meredith arrived in Perugia in September 2007, it was to study for a semester as part of an exchange program with the University for Foreigners of Perugia. According to friends who lived with her that fall, Meredith was the kind of person who filled a room with her presence, attentive to local culture, diligent in her studies, and always ready for an impromptu conversation about art, literature, or Italian language nuances. She lived in a modest three-bedroom apartment on Via della Pergola with three roommates, apologies for butchering their names, Mila Romanelli, a fellow British student, Laura Mazzetti, an Italian student, and of course, the American Amanda Knox. A fourth roommate, Raffaella Solicito, had actually moved out a few weeks before the murder. The apartment itself was located in a historic part of Perugia, within walking distance of both the university and the city's medieval piazzas. In the weeks leading up to November 2007, Meredith plunged herself into normal student life, attending classes at the university, practicing Italian with local friends, exploring local villages, and enjoying evenings at small cafes and bars around town. But Perugia, though quaint and storied, was not immune to university town tensions. Occasional petty thefts, sporadic bar fights, and rumors of underworld activity crept into local headlines. None of these things ever directly impinged on Meredith's sense of safety. She felt at home in Perugia, embraced the local culture, and was quite at ease walking back to her apartment nearly every night. By November 1st, 2007, the autumnal chill had settled into Perugia's cobblestone streets. Meredith and her roommates had spent the evening at a local pub in the nearby town of Castello, celebrating Halloween with friends from the university. Shortly after midnight, Mila and Meredith left the pub to walk back about a 40-minute journey on foot, passing through dimly lit streets and across the Corso Vannucci, Perugia's main thoroughfare. The two had attended a Halloween blanket party, and witnesses later placed them leaving the venue in around midnight-ish, apparently chatting in good spirits. Around 11:30 p.m., Amanda Knox and dermatology student Rafael Solicito had opted to stay in at their separate homes. Knox at Via della Pergola and Sollicito at his parents' apartment, approximately 15 minutes away by motorcycle. Knox and Sollicito have been dating for a few weeks, but reportedly had a brief falling out that night. Some reports suggest that Knox sent Sollicito an angry text message around 10:30 p.m., complaining about some perceived slight. Sollicito's motorcycle, parked in front of the police station around 9 p.m., would later become the center of contradictory alibi claims. At about 1 a.m. on November 2nd, 2007, a neighbor in the Villa Via della Pergola apartment complex heard a blood-curdling scream. The neighbor later testified that she had heard what sounded like a violent altercation, but given the narrow staircases and thin walls of historic Perugia buildings, the exact origin was unclear. Shortly before 1:30 a.m., another neighbor noticed the light on in Meredith's room, despite having seen the roommates leave earlier. A few minutes later, the neighbor walked down the hall and saw a white figure lying across the threshold of Meredith's bedroom door. Meredith's own body, her face coated in blood. He screamed, alerting other neighbors, and prompted a frantic call to the Italian military police at approximately 1:26 a.m. By the time the first responders arrived, they found Meredith's body in a gruesome state, lying face up on the floor, her throat cut roughly from ear to ear, her wrists bound by a leather strap bound to a piece of ice pick handle, later identified as part of a metal frame. There was a large laceration on her neck, indicating an attempt to sever the artery, and her black bra was found pushed up around her shoulders, while her jeans were around her ankles. Forensic pathologists later determined she had multiple shallow knife wounds on her body, the most serious of which was the fatal wound to her neck. According to a local pathologist, Meredith's death was horrifically swift. Severe bleeding induced near-instant loss of consciousness, leading to death within minutes. From the moment Meredith's body was discovered, the perimeter around the villa was sealed off, and investigators began swarming the apartment. Later joined by the local police, within hours, forensic teams combed the apartment for evidence, fingerprints, footprints, blood spatters, and DNA. Yet almost immediately, the investigation was beset by missteps, speculation, and a sense of urgency that would eventually complicate the case. Despite having no physical wounds, Amanda Knox became one of the earliest suspects, primarily because of her behavior in the hours after Meredith's death. Several interviewed neighbors claimed Knox was behaving erratically, crying, hitting a radiator, and pacing back and forth. Knox and Sollicito initially told police they had spent the evening together at Sollicito's apartment, watching movies and having sex, but the timeline was ambiguous. Sollicito's alibi hinged on his claim that he had cooked dinner, but forensic analysis later disputed the estimated time the meal was prepared. And we'll talk about that shortly. During the course of a grueling 4-day interrogation, Knox at times, unrepresented by a lawyer and under prolonged questioning, signed a handwritten statement confessing to being present when Meredith died, claiming that it was Guede, a serial offender whose DNA would eventually be found at the scene, who had killed Meredith. In that statement, Knox wrote, "Meredith was killed by Rudy alone," essentially framing Guede, a serial, as the one who acted alone. However, parts of the statement were contradictory. For example, Knox claimed she was out on the balcony when she heard Meredith scream, yet forensic evidence suggested Guede had been inside the apartment long before that. Knox insisted later that she had been coerced, that police had pressed her into writing a false confession to protect herself amid confusion and fatigue. In the days immediately following the murder, Sollicito also offered various accounts. He said he was with Knox until around 11 p.m., then went to his parents' house at 11 p.m., despite witnesses placing Knox at Solicito's flat until 11:45 p.m. It was this tangled web of shifting alibis and Knox's own handwritten notes that landed both her and Sollicito under formal investigation. By November 6th, police formally named Amanda Knox and Rafael Sollicito as suspects, and Guede was identified as a person of interest. Shortly after Knox and Sollicito became suspects, investigators identified Rudy Herman Guede, 21-year-old Ivorian drifter, as another possible perpetrator. Guede had been living in Perugia for several years. Known locally as a petty thief and club-hopping bouncer, his DNA was found on Meredith's body, in her room and on her bra, while his fingerprints were discovered on a pillowcase. Moreover, Guede had fled Perugia 3 days after the murder, traveling to Germany. German authorities arrested Guede on November 19, 2007, at the Frankfurt airport for attempting entry with a forged French passport. After extraditing him to Italy, Guédé was charged with Meredith's murder. Throughout the investigation, Guédé's story remained somewhat consistent. He admitted to having been in Meredith's room that night, but he insisted the crime had been a spontaneous act of sexual violence that spiraled out of control. According to Guédé, he arrived at the villa after failing to find. While Guédé's fingerprints and DNA unquestionably tied him to the scene, the question remained, could Guédé have acted alone? Moreover, how did Knox's blood land in the hallway near Meredith's room? How did Solicito's DNA end up on Meredith's bra clasp? And what are the bloody footprints on the bathroom mat that seemed to match Solicito's footprints from his kitchen? These contradictions gave prosecutors fodder to argue that Knox and Solicito were present and complicit, working in concert with Guédé. On October 8, 2008, the trial of Amanda Knox, Rafael Solicito, and Rudy Guédé formally opened in, I'm not even going to try to pronounce the court's name, in Perugia. The prosecution, led by Giuliano Magnini and Carlo Viciotti, presented a narrative in which all three had conspired to break into the apartment on the night of November 1st, 2007, intending to burglarize the place. They further argued that the break-in had gone completely wrong, leading to a violent altercation in which Meredith was killed. Magnini insisted that Knox and Solicito had been intimate with each other during the early morning hours, checked on Meredith, discovered Guédé raping her, and then participated in the brutal murder, either by holding her down or assisting Guédé in the stabbing. Knox's allegedly false confession, in the presence of both her blood and Solicito's DNA on key crime scene items, were pivotal pieces of evidence. Meanwhile, Rudy Guédé's fast-track trial proceeded separately because he had opted for a fast-track proceeding, the Italian equivalent of a plea bargain combined with a reduced sentence. His case moved more swiftly. On October 28, 2008, Guédé was convicted of sexual assault and murder and sentenced to 30 years in prison. But prosecutors contended that he acted in concert with Knox and Solicito, thus both of them were indicted for murder, sexual violence, and criminal association, and accessory to murder. The crux of the forensic evidence against Knox and Solicito rested on several key elements. The bra clasp, Knox's bloody footprint, DNA on the knife, mixed DNA traces. And during the trial, which was broadcast live by some media and closely followed by global news outlets, both Knox and Solicito took the stand in their defense. Solicito maintained that he had fallen asleep while Knox watched DVDs in his apartment. He claimed she had left around 9 p.m. and returned around 11:45 p.m., discovered a bloodied Knox in tears, and then tried to assist her in cleaning up. Knox insisted she had nothing to do with Meredith's death, describing her own nighttime presence as limited to lounging in the living room, hearing a scream from Meredith's room, and discovering the body. Despite their denials, on December 5, 2009, the court convicted Knox and Solicito of murder, sexual violence, and slander. Knox was also convicted of slandering an Italian bar owner, Patrick Lumumba, whom she initially alleged had killed Meredith. Solicito received a 25-year sentence. Knox was sentenced to 26 years, a verdict that shocked many observers and sparked protests both in Italy and abroad. The court also ordered the payment of 300,000 euros in compensation to the Kircher family and significant sums to other civil plaintiffs. Almost immediately after the convictions, the case became pretty much tabloid fodder. Tabloids fixated on Amanda Knox's nicknaming, focused on Amanda Knox, nicknaming her Foxy Knoxy, and painting her alternately as a calculating femme fatale, or naive dumb blonde. Documentaries, talk shows, and blog posts rehashed every available detail, real or speculative, of Knox's private life, her sex life with Solicito, and her alleged tattoo of a shady figure. Her friends and family claim the Italian media have vilified her without evidence. Knox's mother often appeared on American news networks, criticizing the Italian legal system as archaic and prone to tunnel vision investigations. In contrast, Guédé's conviction received far less attention outside of Italy, despite the fact that he alone would likely have been capable of carrying out the murder. His fast-track trial focused on his own DNA, his African-style prayer mats found in Meredith's room, and eyewitness accounts that placed him running down Via della Perugia wearing latex gloves and covered in blood. By the time Knox and Solicito were convicted, Guede was already serving his sentence. The Kircher family, particularly Meredith's parents, were thrust unwillingly into the spotlight. From their home in Colson, they endured grief magnified by intrusive media interviews and misinformed reporting. They desperately lobbied for a fair trial and insisted that their daughter had been brutally violated. Yet they also expressed sympathy for Guede's own background, recognizing that poverty and trauma might have led him to a life of petty crime, though they could not fathom how that violence culminated in their daughter's death. In late 2010, Knox and Solicito filed appeals to overturn their convictions. In Italy, the appellate system essentially constitutes a new trial where evidence is re-examined, new witnesses can testify, and forensic findings can be challenged. The appeal hearings commenced in Perugia in September 2011 with a new panel of judges under the direction of Judge Hellman. The central theme of the appeal was the forensic evidence, particularly the knife and DNA findings. Independent reports commissioned by the defense, including prominent forensic scientist Luciano Garofano, scrutinized the prosecution's claims. They argued that the knife found on Solicito's knife was too small to have inflicted the fatal wound. Photographs and measurements showed the blade was narrower than the width of the incised wound on Meredith's neck. Moreover, photographers admitted to stretching the photo of the blade to make it resemble the murder wound, which undermined the prosecution's core argument. The mixed blood evidence in the hallway was reanalyzed. An expert concluded that the tests used by the Carabinieri were prone to contamination and did not rise to the legal standard required to conclusively tie Knox's blood to Meredith. The bra clasp was recovered weeks after the crime scene had been cleaned, as it was hidden behind a pipe in the small bathroom. By the time it was found, the bathroom had been sponged down multiple times by roommates, family members, journalists, and investigators. Experts for the defense suggested that contamination from police gloves or other objects could have transferred Solicito's fingerprints onto the clasp. With these points in mind, on October 3, 2011, the appellate court delivered a stunning verdict. Amanda Knox and Rafael Solicito were acquitted of all charges related to Meredith's murder. The court decreed that the DNA and fingerprint evidence against them were riddled with errors and contamination, and that there was no credible chain of evidence placing them at the scene at the time of the murder. Knox and Solicito were declared free to return to their lives. Knox immediately headed back to Seattle, and Solicito to Bari. Their release was met with uproar. Protests erupted outside Perugia's courthouse, with some calling for the judges to be prosecuted for judicial error. In contrast, supporters of Knox in the U.S. celebrated the verdict, decrying the Italian justice system's initial handling of the case. For Meredith's parents, the acquittal felt like a gut punch. In public statements, the parents insisted they believed new evidence had surfaced in favor of their daughter's killers, and that they would continue fighting for a definitive conclusion. They made clear, however, they had no animosity towards Knox and Solicito themselves. They believed Knox had been a victim of coercive interrogation, and Solicito had been drawn into events for which he bore no direct responsibility. But neither did they believe Guede alone had committed the murder in the way he described. And at this point, Guede was still serving his sentence. Under Italian law, the public prosecutor, or private citizens, in this instance, the Kircher family, could appeal the partial verdict that had acquitted Knox and Solicito of murder. In 2013, Judge Luigi Riello of Rome's Supreme Court of Cassation reviewed the appellate ruling. While this court does not retry cases based on new evidence, they assess whether the law was properly applied. On January 19, 2013, Judge Riello declared the appeal verdict legally unsound and ordered a new trial. Specifically, the Supreme Court singled out the appellate court's dismissal of the knife evidence and the bra clasp, stating that Judge Hellman's reasoning was inconsistent and incomplete. Consequently, Knox and Solicito were returned to the state of accused and a new appeal trial would commence. The retrial began in Perugia in January 2014, presided over by Judge Claudio Pertillo, Hellman, the same judge who had acquitted them 2 years prior, and with a fresh panel of two additional judges. Over the next several months, the court once again heard forensic expert testimony with state-appointed experts, reaffirming the link between Solicito's fingerprints on the bra clasp and Knox's DNA on the knife blade. The prosecution introduced expert witnesses who posited that the knives used in the 2007 crime scene correlated with the scaling of infection and wound pattern on Meredith's neck, Knox and Celisa Till remained free during the retrial, but they were under strict scrutiny and had to travel back to Italy for hearings, incurring significant personal expense. On January 30th, 2014, after nearly a year of legal wrangling, the Perugia Appeals Court, overturning the prior acquittal, convicted Amanda Knox and Celisa Till again. Knox was sentenced to 28 and a half years, Celisa Till to 25 years. Italian press coverage was triumphant. National newspapers splashed headlines proclaiming that justice had been restored and that the murderers of Meredith Kircher had finally been found guilty. Across social media, however, many remained skeptical. Critics pointed to the same forensic weaknesses identified during the first appeal and questioned the court's reliance on reinterpreted evidence. By the time the verdict was handed down in January 2014, most of the world had grown weary of the cases back and forth. But the final twist was still to come. In March 2015, Knox and Celisa Till appealed to Italy's Supreme Court for a third time. On March 27, 2015, the court arrived at its ultimate decision, indisputably confirming Knox and Celisa Till's complete exoneration. In its final 105-page ruling, the Court of Cassation declared that there were, quote, no elements that support the theory that Amanda Knox and Raphael Celisa Till participated in the killing of Meredith Kircher. More specifically, the court criticized the repeated reliance on flimsy DNA evidence, inconsistent expert reports, and the fact that the prosecution's theory of the crime had not been adequately substantiated. Thus, after 7 years in which Knox had spent 4 years in an Italian prison and another year on house arrest, the Supreme Court finally restored her to full innocence. Raphael Celisa Till, who had spent less time incarcerated, also regained his life. Both were financially ruined by legal fees, endured years of public scrutiny, and had their relationships and studies severely disrupted. Amanda Knox's book, Waiting to be Heard, was published in 2013, chronicling her ordeal. In 2021, Knox and Celisa Till launched defamation lawsuits in the U.S. against several media organizations that propagated false claims about them. Most of those suits were ultimately dismissed, primarily on the grounds that the publications had relied on publicly available court documents. While Knox and Celisa Till's legal roller coaster captured global attention, Rudy Guedes served the longest uninterrupted portion of his sentence. In October 2008, after his fast-track conviction, Guedes was sentenced to a 30-year prison term. In November 2008, he was transferred to a prison on the island of Santo Stefano, where inmates endured severe overcrowding and harsh conditions. In 2013, his sentence was reduced to 16 years, citing good behavior and procedural ambiguities in his fast-track trial. By 2014, he was transferred to a more lenient prison regime, and he was eventually moved to a semi-liberty prison where he could work and study outside of prison walls. On January 30th, 2021, Guedes was officially released from prison, having served approximately 13 years of his 16-year sentence. Guedes has consistently denied involvement in Meredith's murder beyond his own partial confession in 2008. He's claimed he never intended to kill Meredith, that it was a crime of passion, and that Knox and Celisa Till had nothing to do with it. Given the final acquittal of Knox and Celisa Till, Guedes stands today as the only person criminally responsible for Meredith's death. Yet many aspects of the case remain ambiguous. Did Guedes act entirely alone? If so, why did he never reveal the full story of how he entered the apartment, how the attack unfolded, and how Knox and Celisa Till might have crossed his path? The truth, in many ways, remains locked with Guedes' own accounts, which are inconsistent and often self-serving. Although the Supreme Court's verdict in 2015 should have brought the matter to a close, Meredith's murder continues to be the subject of speculation, documentaries, podcasts, books, and even feature films. Some fundamental questions linger. Did Guedes act alone? Why was there no forced entry? And of course, the forensic record, media and public perception, and the Kircher's family long road. Meredith Kircher's murder and the subsequent legal odyssey cast a stark light on the interplay between media frenzy and the administration of justice. If anything positive emerged from this serious tragedy, it was a renewed emphasis on crime scene integrity, DNA testing protocols, and international cooperation in police investigations. Italian authorities, chastened by the criticisms, overhauled some forensic procedures, insisting that crime scene photography be shot from multiple angles, that multiple gloves be worn and documented, and that chain of custody records be meticulously maintained. In the United Kingdom, awareness of study abroad safety protocols rose significantly in the wake of Meredith's death. British universities implemented stricter campus security guidelines, including late-night escort services for students, secure apartment entry systems, and improved coordination with local law enforcement in popular foreign exchange destinations. Though such measures cannot undo the damage of Meredith's loss, they stand as a testament to the impact one life's tragedy can have on institutional practices and student safety worldwide. The Kircher's family perseverance in honoring Meredith's murder has created positive ripples in several areas. The Kircher Scholarship Fund, art therapy initiatives, and of course, lectures and fundraisers. On November 2nd, 2007, the world lost a bright young person who had an entire life ahead of her. In the 8 years that followed, two innocent people were convicted and incarcerated, only to be exonerated after spending thousands of nights fighting for their freedom. Rudy Guede remains the only individual to have been definitively convicted for Meredith's murder. Yet many questions about his sole responsibility remain open. The Kircher family, fractured by grief, never received a coherent narrative exactly how Meredith died, and neither did the public. Yet out of this tragedy, new protocols for forensic rigor emerged. British universities reevaluated student safety abroad, and memory of Meredith continues to inspire art therapy programs and scholarships. Ultimately, Meredith's murder teaches us that truth and justice are not simple equations. They require patience, unbiased inquiry, and a steadfast commitment to the human beings in the center of every case. We owe it to Meredith and to all victims of violent crime to strive for clarity, to honor lives instead of sensationalizing deaths, and to ensure that no one else must endure the kind of uncertainty and emotional turmoil that the Kircher family, Amanda Knox, Raphael Solicito, and the citizens of Perugia experience. In remembering Meredith Kircher, we are reminded that behind every headline is a human story, one that deserves to be told with compassion, accuracy, and unwavering respect. And that is the story of the murder of Meredith Kircher. Let me know your thoughts on this case. Do you think Amanda Knox is innocent, or is she actually still hiding the truth? Perhaps one day we'll eventually find out the complete truth of this murder. And with that, give us a thumbs up if you like our video. If you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. Or if you see this QR code, you can scan it, that one right there, and donate to the channel that way. And with that, thank you so much for watching and listening. We will see you next time.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.